Chapter 11. I said, Most noble, grave, and reverend Signer, on or about the 10th day of October, 1861, John Wilson Mackin, that is sufficient, sir. I have heard of you. Go to the first auditor of the treasury. I did so. He sent me to the second auditor. The second auditor sent me to the third, and the third sent me to the first controller of the corn-beef division. This began to look like business. He examined his books and all his loose papers, but found no minute of the beef contract. I went to the second controller of the corn-beef division. He examined his books and his loose papers, but with no success. I was encouraged. During that week I got as far as the sixth controller in that division. The next week I got through the claims department. The third week I began and completed the mislaid contracts department, and got a foothold in the dead reckoning department. I finished that in 3 days. There was only one place left for it now. I laid siege to the commissioner of odds and ends. To his clerk, rather, he was not there himself. There were 16 beautiful young ladies in the room, writing in books, and there were 7 well-favored young clerks showing them how. The young women smiled up over their shoulders, and the clerks smiled back at them, and all went merry as a marriage bell. 2 or 3 clerks, that were reading the newspapers, looked at me rather hard, but went on reading, and nobody said anything. However, I had been used to this kind of alacrity from fourth assistant junior clerks all through my eventful career, from the very day I entered the first office of the Corned Beef Bureau clear till I passed out of the last one in the dead reckoning division. I had got so accomplished by this time, that I could stand on one foot from the moment I entered an office till a clerk spoke to me, without changing more than 2, or maybe 3, times. So I stood there till I had changed 4 different times. Then I said to one of the clerks who was reading, Illustrious vagrant, where is the Grand Turk? What do you mean, sir? Whom do you mean? If you mean the chief of the bureau, he is out. Will he visit the harem today? The young man glared upon me a while, and then went on reading his paper. But I knew the ways of those clerks. I knew I was safe, if he got through before another New York mail arrived. He only had 2 more papers left. After a while he finished them, and then he yawned and asked me what I wanted. Renowned and honored imbecile. On or about, you are the beef contract man. Give me your papers. He took them, and for a long time he ransacked his odds and ends. Finally he found the Northwest Passage. As I regarded it, he found the long-lost record of that beef contract. He found the rock upon which so many of my ancestors had split before they ever got to it. I was deeply moved. And yet I rejoiced, for I had survived. I said with emotion, Give it me. The government will settle now. He waved me back, and said there was something yet to be done first. Where is this John Wilson Mackenzie? Said he. Dead. When did he die? He didn't die at all, he was killed. How? Tomahawked. Who tomahawked him? Why, an Indian, of course. You didn't suppose it was the superintendent of a Sunday school, did you? No. An Indian, was it? The same. Name of the Indian? His name? I don't know his name. Must have his name. Who saw the tomahawking done? I don't know. You were not present yourself then? Which you can see by my hair. I was absent. Then how do you know that Mackenzie is dead? Because he certainly died at that time, and have every reason to believe that he has been dead ever since. I know he has, in fact. We must have proofs. Have you got this Indian? Of course not. Well, you must get him. Have you got the tomahawk? I never thought of such a thing. You must get the tomahawk. You must produce the Indian and the tomahawk. If Mackenzie's death can be proven by these, you can then go before the commission appointed to audit claims with some show of getting your bill under such headway that your children may possibly live to receive the money and enjoy it. But that man's death must be proven. However, I may as well tell you that the government will never pay that transportation and those traveling expenses of the lamented Mackenzie. It may possibly pay for the barrel of beef that Sherman's soldiers captured, if you can get a relief bill through Congress making an appropriation for that purpose, but it will not pay for the 29 barrels the Indians ate. Then there is only $100 due me, and that isn't certain. After all Mackenzie's travels in Europe, Asia, and America with that beef, after all his trials and tribulations and transportation, after the slaughter of all those innocents that tried to collect that bill. Young man, why didn't the first controller of the corned beef division tell me this? He didn't know anything about the genuineness of your claim. Why didn't the second tell me? Why didn't the third? Why didn't all those divisions and departments tell me? None of them knew. We do things by routine here. You have followed the routine and found out what you wanted to know. It is the best way. It is the only way. It is very regular, and very slow, but it is very certain. Yes, certain death. It has been, to the most of our tribe. I begin to feel that I too, am called. Young man, you love the bright creature yonder with the gentle blue eyes, and the steel pens behind her ears. I see it in your soft glances. You wish to marry her, but you are poor. Here, hold out your hand, here is the beef contract. Go, take her and be happy. Heaven bless you, my children. This is all I know about the great beef contract that has created so much talk in the community. The clerk to whom I bequeathed it died. I know nothing further about the contract, or anyone connected with it. I only know that, if a man lives long enough he can trace a thing through the Circumlocution Office of Washington and find out, after much labor and trouble and delay, that which he could have found out on the first day, if the business of the Circumlocution Office were as ingeniously systematized as it would be if it were a great private mercantile institution. The case of George Fisher, some years ago, about 1867, when this was first published, few people believed it, but considered it a mere extravaganza. In these latter days it seems hard to realize that there was ever a time when the robbing of our government was a novelty. The very man who showed me where to find the documents for this case was at that very time spending hundreds of thousands of dollars in Washington for a mail steamship concern, in the effort to procure a subsidy for the company, a fact which was a long time in coming to the surface, but leaked out at last and underwent congressional investigation. This is history. It is not a wild extravaganza, like Owen Wilson Mackenzie's great beef contract, but is a plain statement of facts and circumstances with which the Congress of the United States has interested itself from time to time during the long period of half a century. I will not call this matter of George Fisher's a great deathless and unrelenting swindle upon the government and people of the United States, dash for it has never been so decided, and I hold that it is a grave and solemn wrong for a writer to cast slurs or call names when such is the case, but will simply present the evidence and let the reader deduce his own verdict. Then we shall do nobody injustice, and our consciences shall be clear. On or about the first day of September, 1813, the Creek War being then in progress in Florida, the crops, herds, and houses of Mr. George Fisher, a citizen, were destroyed, either by the Indians or by the United States troops in pursuit of them. By the terms of the law, if the Indians destroyed the property, there was no relief for Fisher. But if the troops destroyed it, the government of the United States was debtor to Fisher for the amount involved. George Fisher must have considered that the Indians destroyed the property because, although he lived several years afterward, he does not appear to have ever made any claim upon the government. In the course of time, Fisher died, and his widow married again. and by, nearly 20 years after that dimly remembered raid upon Fisher's cornfields, the widow Fisher's new husband petitioned Congress for pay for the property, and backed up the petition with many depositions, and affidavits which purported to prove that the troops, and not the Indians, destroyed the property, that the troops, for some inscrutable reason, deliberately burned down houses or cabins, valued at $600, the same belonging to a peaceable private citizen, and also destroyed various other property belonging to the same citizen. But Congress declined to believe that the troops were such idiots after overtaking and scattering a band of Indians proved to have been found destroying Fisher's property as to calmly continue the work of destruction themselves, and make a complete job of what the Indians had only commenced. So Congress denied the petition of the heirs of George Fisher in 1832, and did not pay them a cent. We hear no more from them officially until 1848, 16 years after their first attempt on the treasury, and a full generation after the death of the man whose fields were destroyed. The new generation of Fisher heirs then came forward, and put in a bill for damages. The second auditor awarded them $8,873, being half the damage sustained by Fisher. The auditor said the testimony showed that at least half the destruction was done by the Indians ever the troops started in pursuit, and of course the government was not responsible for that half. 2. That was in April, 1848. In December, 1848, the heirs of George Fisher, deceased, came forward and pleaded for a revision of their bill of damages. The revision was made, but nothing new could be found in their favor except an error of $100 in the former calculation. However, in order to keep up the spirits of the Fisher family, the auditor concluded to go back and allow interest from the date of the first petition, 1832, to the date when the bill of damages was awarded. This sent the Fishers home happy with 16 years interest on $8,873, the same amounting to $8,997.994. Total, $17,870.94. 3. For an entire year the suffering Fisher family remained quiet, even satisfied, after a fashion. Then they swooped down upon the government with their wrongs once more. That old patriot, Attorney General Towsey, burrowed through the moldy papers of the Fishers, and discovered one more chance for the desolate orphans' interest on that original award of $8,873 from date of destruction of the property 1813 up to 1832. Result, $110,004.889 for the indigent Fishers. So now we have, first, $8,873 damages. Second, interest on it from 1832 to 1848, $8,997.994. Third, interest on it dated back to 1813, $10,004.889. Total, $27,875.83. What better investment for a great-grandchild than to get the Indians to burn a cornfield for him 60 or 70 years before his birth, and plausibly lay it on lunatic United States troops? 4. Strange as it may seem, the Fishers let Congress alone for 5 years, or, what is perhaps more likely, failed to make themselves heard by Congress for that length of time. But at last, in 1854, they got a hearing. They persuaded Congress to pass an act requiring the auditor to re-examine their case. But this time they stumbled upon the misfortune of an honest Secretary of the Treasury, Mr. James Guthrie, and he spoiled everything. He said in very plain language that the Fishers were not only not entitled to another cent, but that those children of many sorrows and acquainted with grief had been paid too much already. 5. Therefore another interval of rest and silence ensued, an interval which lasted 4 years, viz. Till 1858. The right man in the right place was then Secretary of War John B. Floyd, of peculiar renown. Here was a master intellect. Here was the very man to succor the suffering heirs of dead and forgotten Fisher. They came up from Florida with a rush, a great tidal wave of Fishers freighted with the same old moldy documents about the same immortal cornfields of their ancestor. They straightway got an act passed transferring the Fisher matter from the dull auditor to the ingenious Floyd. What did Floyd do? He said, it was proved that the Indians destroyed everything they could before the troops entered in pursuit. He considered, therefore, that what they destroyed must have consisted of the houses with all their contents, and the liquor the most trifling part of the destruction, and set down at only $3. 200 all told, and that the government troops then drove them off, and calmly proceeded to destroy 220 acres of corn in the field, 35 acres of wheat, and 986 head of livestock. What a singularly intelligent army we had in those days, according to Mr. Floyd, though not according to the Congress of 1832. So Mr. Floyd decided that the government was not responsible for that $3.200 worth of rubbish which the Indians destroyed, but was responsible for the property destroyed by the troops, which property consisted of, I quote from the printed United States Senate document, $ corn at Bassett's Creek, $3,000 cattle, $5,000 stock hogs, $1,050 drove hogs, $1,204 wheat, $350 hides, $4,000 corn on the Alabama River, $3,500 total, $18,104. That sum, in his report, Mr. Floyd calls the L value of the property destroyed by the troops. He allows that sum to the starving Fishers, together with interest from 1813. From this new sum total the amounts already paid to the Fishers were deducted, and then the cheerful remainder, a fraction under $40,000, was handed to them, and again they retired to Florida in a condition of temporary tranquility. Their ancestors' farm had now yielded them altogether nearly $67,000 in cash. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.